everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality and spatial computing. And today I'm your host, Oz Balabadian, and with me is Peter Leckhoff. Hey, Peter.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Peter. And today we are going to be talking about the Magic Leap 1. Ah, the one episode we have been excited about for years. About, because we really have been.
That's true.
For a podcast that really concentrates on display technologies, on optics, and how physiologically things work when it comes to VR and spatial computing, the Magic Leap has really been something that we've talked about a long time. We've talked about the problem of vergence and accommodation, and the various ways, the various solutions to fix it, and today we're going to talk about Magic Leap and if they accomplished some of the problems that they set out to accomplish, to solve. And what does that look like? You know, what were their solutions? Why were their solutions the solutions that they picked? And what we can expect moving forward. So without further ado, this is the Magic Leap. I wouldn't consider this a fully comprehensive review of the headset. For that, I will refer to our friends at Tested that did a really awesome, like a 15-minute long review, video review about the headset, you know, the controller, the OS, all that awesome stuff that you can go into. And if you are interested as a developer, like what is being done on the development side of the Magic Leap, we highly recommend you check out the Twitter page called Made with Magic Leap. And there's all these developers and part of something called the Leap Squad that really have been pushing the boundaries of like what can be done with a device like the Magic Leap 1. So highly encouraged to check out some of their experiments and projects because there's some really solid ideas there. But today, again, like I said, we are concentrating on just the display technology. This is something that we have been excited about, and that was, to be quite honest, this was the first and the main thing that I really cared about. I didn't want the hype to really, you know, either build expectations for me or to I didn't want to approach this headset with any positive or negative connotations. I just wanted to see, I was very much expecting to see a next generation display that had accommodation built in as a core functionality. And what we got was not particularly that. So let me describe the scenario. And actually, as a full disclaimer, Magic Leap has been running this program to give creators and developers in this community a Magic Leap so that they can start experimenting with it, building with them. And I luckily was one of them. So thank you, Magic Leap, for giving me a headset. Because I sure as hell was not going to be able to afford one by myself. Just as a note, I do think the Magic Leap 1 is quite a decent AR headset, and it's something that I'm using for a personal project, a documentary film, a volumetric film that I've been working on to premiere in VR, but now we'll also have an AR component because the format of that film works super well for both headsets. We'll talk way more about this.
That's what I actually was going to ask. You know, when do you expect when it comes out?
We'll talk more about this in the next few months. It's been something that I've been working on for the past year, but I haven't felt like it's been in a good position to publicly like reveal yet. But we're getting there. So with that, with all the caveats aside, and you know, I think it's a fine headset. The first time I put on the Magic Leap 1, the first thing I wanted to try was putting a plane far away from me and a plane very close to me and closing one eye and switching focus from one plane to the next. This was the first thing I tried when someone gave me a demo of a light field mixed reality headset. This was the Avogand prototype that they were showing off about a year and a half ago. And I was very much impressed with that. And this is something that doesn't exist yet in VR, or at least not in the consumer side. And I thought Magic Leap would be, like I was expecting Magic Leap to really knock me out of the park on this, just on this element itself. If you've been listening to this podcast, you've heard us talk about the vergence accommodation problem. Let me give you the background as to why I put these planes in front of each other and tried to switch focus. So the vergence accommodation problem has been something that VR or stereoscopic displays have had for the last, I don't know, decades, right? Even for as long as they have existed in research. It's because we only use two. It's because of the way your eyes work, and because a lot of listeners have heard this before, we'll keep it short. Vergence is a way of your eyes going cross-eyed, essentially, by looking at something up close, right? If you hold your fingers in front of you and you look at it, your eyes are crossing over each other, and to an outsider, if they're just looking at your face, you look like cross-eyed. And that's one of the ways your eyes really can determine where something is in space. It's by using two cameras, right? Two eyes, and then the difference of rotation that they do, that they pull on each eye, gives that physiological feedback that your brain can use to understand, oh, that this thing is, you know, this many centimeters in front of me, or this many meters in front of me. But you can imagine that stops at but you can imagine that actually is not enough. A second way we can understand where things are in space, right, understanding depth, is you don't even need two eyes. You can use just one eye. And if you close one eye and you look at that close up object, that hand or that finger, you realize everything behind that hand is blurry. And it's a similar effect to what we see in cameras and film, right? It's like a nice technique you can use called focus pulling, when you're moving the thing you're focused on in the video from something up close to something far. And it's a really nice way of directing attention, but it's actually mimicking the way your eyes work. It's this aperture inside of your eye, this lens that can constrict or grow big, and it allows for more light to come in and focus on different things in different focal planes. And that is called accommodation, right? Just remember these two things, vergence and accommodation. Vergence, think converge. Accommodation, think lens or focus pulling. VR headsets, the HoloLens, and every other stereoscopic display currently only supports vergence. It's because the lenses themselves are fixed at a focal plane, typically around a meter or meter and a half in front of you, but they have two screens, so one screen per eye, and each screen shows a slightly different image. And so your eyes can basically converge on the thing in the world, and your brain can understand where that thing is. However, this breaks at certain distances. Like if you hold up something up really close to your face in VR, you're not going to be able to focus on it properly. And it actually kind of gives you a headache sometimes if you look at something up close for too long. That's called eye fatigue. That is something that Magic Leap has set out to fix. That was always, even if you go back and read that AMA that, you know, Ronnie Abovitz did about 3 years ago now, that was the main differentiating factor that he really wanted to point to, was the fact that he said 3D stereoscopic displays, you know, are physiologically incorrect. And there was a controversial comment in there about them causing, you know, perhaps some damage, some kind of permanent damage to your eye, and thank you to our audience, actually. You guys are a pretty awesome bunch of academics and researchers. I've reached out to a few people that are researchers in the perceptual fields to ask about this claim. Like, is there really any evidence to suggest that if you look at something that, let's say, is you're converging on but isn't in the right focal plane for where your eyes are focused to, like, does that cause any sort of damage? And no one really seems to have any concrete evidence of it causing any sort of like semi-permanent to permanent damage. If anything, it just causes eye fatigue if you do it for long enough. And I mean, but that is not permanent damage.
Yeah, and there was also this one paper that was actually frequently quoted by the CEO, right? The zone of comfort predicting visual discomfort with stereo displays. That when we actually managed to read through, because it's a pretty long paper, it kind of is not necessarily answering anything that is related to the Magic Leap. So I would argue.
I did figure out, Peter, actually, what it can be used to relate to.
Okay, now I'm excited.
the one piece of science that we've seen Roni link to is this paper that Peter just mentioned. And it's basically something built to test. It was a paper, or it was a study built to test 3D displays and seeing how much pop out effects you could do without it causing eye fatigue. So, you know, your cinema display is at a fixed distance from you. You're focusing on at that distance, but with the way, you know, 3D movies work, you can have things popping out of the screen or pushing into the screen. How much wiggly room do you have with that before it really causes any sort of trouble? Yeah, exactly. Trouble being discomfort, not permanent damage or anything. They came up with this chart, basically, this not a linear chart, but it's a sort of logarithmic chart of how much room you have to push things in and out. And it actually, there's a bunch of variables. Like one variable is the distance from you to the screen. Is the second variable is like the size of the screen itself. Like there's a few variables that can be measured. And it's like, I mean, basically they had a few significant conclusions.
So, I mean, what they basically looked, you know, is kind of cinema style setups, right? Where you have like those huge projections in front of you. And this is also, to be honest, I mean, this paper is very, very, very detailed, but it's, you know, I think 22, 25 subjects, whatever they had. And also a lot of the statistical data they performed on subjective questionnaires that, while being scientifically valid, also leave, you know, certain room for interpretation.
So, yeah, it basically, the conclusions that they were able to draw, or this chart that they were able to build, I think is what Roni is using as justification for the near clip plane cutoff of the Magic Leap 1. So if you've heard about this or tried the Magic Leap, you can't really get up close to objects, right? They clip off things at 27 centimeters, which is right where the first waveguide focal plane is. So that's if you put your arm straight out, it's pretty much where your palm is. Like that is as close to virtual objects as you can get. So this is a huge topic, right? Like why pick this distance? And we've seen Roni basically say this is within the physiological safe zone of operation. We're like, huh, like what does that mean? And so the only science that they've linked to, and they're saying that there's a white paper being worked on that's going to, you know, answer a lot of these questions. And I'm excited to read that when it comes out. But this paper, I think they're using to point to saying if we can only use fixed focal waveguides, then essentially, this fixed focal waveguide can be treated the same way as a 3D TV, where you have only a set wiggle room of how much pop out and push in effects we can do from that fixed focal plane. So if you have that focus plane be way close to you, let's say, you know, a few centimeters away from your face, that wiggle room is going to be very small. So you would need to put a lot of waveguides next to each other to account for that, the small shifts of focus planes. Again, things that are up close, we are much more sensitive to focus. So we have these focal planes, another word for it is called diopter. We have a lot more diopters that are closer to us than are further away. So the further they go out, the less, more room we have for like pushing and push out of
it. Is it kind of similar to a lens of a camera? You know, you can kind of, you know, focus on things in front of you and have a nice bokeh, but try to focus on a building 100 meters away and have a bokeh. It doesn't work out. You have to open, you know, the lens all way up. So the F stops.
And you have to be way more sensitive with like focusing at things up close, right? A little bit of moving, like a little wiggle of the focus, dial on a camera with focusing at something closer is a lot more sensitive than focusing at infinity and everything being in focus.
And maybe to mention, that's why the, you know, virtual projection of an Oculus Rift or, you know, HTC Vive is usually roughly around 10 meters away from you, right?
I think it's not 10 meters, but like with the Oculus DK2, and I think with currently they're like meter to a meter and a half.
Okay,
is the focal distance that they pick. Right, because that so that meter and a half is a good middle ground. If you were to pick one focus plane, that you can focus for your eyes to accommodate to. A meter and a half is distance because you can have games that are using the very far field, you know, and things will work well there. And you can still have productivity apps and things that are up close and your eyes will comfortably focus on that as well. I think an optics engineer told me you have about a half a diopter of wiggle room between where you're focused at and what you can converge on. So half a diopter in front and half a diopter behind. These are the pop out and push-in effects that we're talking about. So for Magic Leap, you know, at some point it seems like they went from having an actual light field display, something that is projecting. Did we define that light field display yet?
No, I think we should first do it. Yeah.
Sorry if I'm jumping around. A light field display, as far as we have been understanding it, and we've covered this in the past, is a form of display that is projecting different rays of light at your eye so that some rays are in focus. And however, you can switch your focus. You can look around this bundle, this volume of light, and be able to switch focus and look at something else. This infinite depth of field idea.
Yeah, it's basically, when you look around yourself, you see light, and everything that you see is a reflection of the light being bounced off. And technically, one could argue that even a photo is kind of a slice of a light field because
thin slice. But with a light field display, you can imagine stacking photos on top of each other so that you're holding a deck of pictures and you're able to like focus through these photos, focus at the things that are closer to you in the photo, focusing on things that are far. From almost every definition that I've seen of light field, both on the camera side, right? Light field cameras are supposed to be capturing the light of things that it's capturing from many different perspectives so that focus can be shifted. A light field display is the converse of that, or the inverse of that, where you can switch your focus on the display side rather than the camera side. So they're kind of two sides of the same coin. But again, so it seems like Magic Leap has been building really advanced optics, and it's from the demos that we've seen, the pictures, that their early prototypes, the WD1, the WD2, things like called like the Beast, that's the earlier version where it wasn't even a wearable device yet. They had really advanced light field optics where you could be switching focus. But at some point, and we saw this in the patents, they stopped patenting, you know, crazy advanced forms of display technology and started patenting stacked waveguides where each waveguide was a fixed focal plane and the other waveguides were fixed at other focal planes. And they were trying to essentially see how many waveguides would you need to really cover the full spectrum of diopters in front of you. So from the patents, we were expecting 5 waveguides, and in reality, it seems like that is both too expensive, too hard to produce, not opaque, because like these waveguides actually are stopping light, you know, real ambient light from going into your eyes. And a lot of just like, you know, problems that I don't even know about because I don't work on the supply chain side of these things. It seems like they just went with 2 waveguides, and these waveguides, and if you have 2 waveguides to pick, and what focal planes are you gonna pick? You're not gonna pick things that are up close. You're gonna pick things that are far away. So the closest being 27 centimeters, which is quite a bit away. This also works in the favor of waveguides because waveguides are limited in their field of view, and because they're limited, if you have anything up close, any object in full scale up close in AR, it's going to get cut off by that field of view. And they're like, okay, let's not worry about things that are up close because they're going to get cut off anyway. Let's just put the near clip plane at 27 centimeters, things where we can expect things to be fully projected in a waveguide, and then we can set the right focus to that and then just, you know, not have to worry about things up close.
And maybe just as a side note, we had actually an episode 47 where we discussed NVIDIA researchers, conference. Yes,
It was a SIGGRAPH.
Exactly.
Last year's SIGGRAPH.
Yes, yep. Researchers demonstrate 100 degree dynamic focus IR display. So they were actually kind of very humble and called it a dynamic focus. Just nice. They didn't even call it, you know, live filter or anything.
Or I think, I mean, I don't know specifically at what display technology they were using. Perhaps it was, you know, it was probably better to call it not a light filled display, because maybe they were like a very focal display in VR is a way of moving either the panel or the lens in front of the panel back and forth to create different focal planes for you to be looking at. And that's, this is how, if you guys were following Facebook's half dome prototype that they showed at F8, they supported this idea of deep focus by moving the, I believe they're moving the optics back and forth when you're looking at something up close. And on top of that, they also at OC5 talked about that they had to, this idea's deep focus is they have to blur out, I guess, on the software side, the background, rather than just rely on your eyes focusing at something up close. Yeah, actually, that makes sense, especially if you don't have a light field. Yeah, if you're not using a light field display, if you do even move the optics so that you're focusing at something up close, everything, the video behind, you know, the RGB image that's being rendered, is still going to render everything at full sharpness. So you do have to blur out the things in the background. So anyway, Oculus seems to have some interesting machine learning tech that they've been working on for that. So again, these are deep, deep concepts. I'm sorry if I'm jumping around or if it's hard to keep up with, but hopefully you are. And if you have any questions, we're happy to help clarify these things. And actually, just to throw a plug out there, I did a shorter version of this podcast as a video on my YouTube channel, that I'm currently editing. So if you want to see a more visual, a simpler explanation of all these things, check it out on YouTube under my name, Oz Balabanian. So, where are we? Am I making sense, Peter?
Yes, you are.
Are we on track here?
We're definitely on track. And just to underline one fact, I mean, this concept of a light field display and the concepts of displaying basically multiple planes or like unlimited planes is something that like, a lot of research has gone into, right? And there have been a lot of different companies trying to achieve it. And what's very interesting, maybe to highlight, is the technology that Magic Leap might have pitched in their early pitches, right? It was based on those rotating,
fiber scanning displays. Yes.
And we should definitely plug the article from Mr. What's his name?
Carl Guttag.
Yeah, because he actually described in one of the articles how it might have been and how it cannot work, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, say what you will about patents with companies and how much you can rely or how much you can understand about what a company is doing from its patents. But Carl was one of the first people that was reading Magic Leap's patents and was saying there's literally no way in hell that a fiber scanning display would work at the resolution that you want it to, or even create a clear, you know, RGB image that you want to. And the only image of a real of a fiber scanning display that even exists, like it just looks like a hue shifted blue image, and it's like doesn't really work very well. Anyway, I don't think that's even what Magic Leap ever built or showed off to anyone. It seems like the earlier iterations that they had were some sort of perhaps a reflective kind of a reflective surface with like a DLP projection, similar, I think, to. Well, I don't want to say anything factually incorrect, but it seemed like they had more advanced optics than a waveguide display that they were licensing from a company called OmniVision, which is what's going on currently.
Yes.
Where this leads us is honestly to Twitter.
Oh yes.
This is.
I think the Twitter. Honestly, Twitter is definitely the main reason why you are so much engaged into this topic, aren't you?
I can't deny that. When I see tweets coming out, you know, that are arguing that Magic Leap 1 is not a stereoscopic display, or I see, you know, tweets coming out that say we are producing a discretized light field, digital light field signal, and, you know, nobody really understands what these terms mean, it makes me slightly skeptical and actually encourages me to look into these terms and see, you know, what is being actually factually said here. You know, are these terms at all descriptive of what they're supposed to be describing? Are they the right label to even put? And so, you know, say what you will about marketing and trying to take these very advanced physics concepts and breaking it down for the everyday consumer. Like that's our bread and butter, right? We like to take these very complicated things and try to break it down. And I know this episode is not a very good example of it because we're not really describing, well, I don't know, at least I think we're describing things simply. But when you try to use more advanced terminology and jargon with reporters that don't know better, it sounds like, oh, this is something advanced than anything I know, so I'm just going to go along with it, right? Like, even I hear Roni use ArcMinute when it comes to talking about, what is the display density, right? The resolution that you want to be projecting at, rather than using conventional terminologies like pixels per inches or pixels per degrees, which is a little bit more accurate for a head-mounted display. He uses the term like ArcMinute instead of like degrees or instead of radians, and like these things. I know from the reporters and friends that I have that are like, what are these, you know, like it requires some Googling, it requires some looking into. And
but not just for reporters. I mean, honestly, this episode is, I think, one of the most prepared ones because we actually had to go through all those definitions, through all those words. And I mean, we are definitely not experts, but we did so far, you know, over 80 episodes, we have been, you know, doing a lot of stuff related to this whole ecosystem, and we are both cognitive scientists, so we should understand science, and it still took an enormous amount of time to actually pile it up.
Yeah, especially on the display side, like, you know, how is a waveguide different than, or how does a waveguide work, and how do these other AR displays work? What currently exists? What are the limitations? What even can be produced on a mass scale, or what makes sense? It really took a lot of research on our end, and this is us being in this field for the last, you know, 3 years. So I guess I have a few tweets that I want to point to and just kind of point my finger at and be like, what? So first, we already kind of talked about the claims about permanent damage or, you know, whatever neurological damage, which again, we found no evidence of, and even speaking with researchers that are active in the field, they don't know of anything. The second one is like Roni arguing with someone that the Magic Leap 1 is not a stereoscopic display. And so I'm like, okay, why would you say this? And even turns out, even in his Reddit AMA, he was also talking about the same thing, that he's trying to differentiate the Magic Leap 1 from 3D stereoscopes or 3D stereoscopic displays. And these are, you know, everything from 100-year-old photogram looking displays, right, which is like basically a piece of tin with like two lenses and a picture in a stereo picture you put in front of and you look at it. And like, again, these are fixed focal displays. Even today's VR headsets are fixed focal displays. And he wants to make the distinction that the Magic Leap will have, because it has accommodation support, is not a stereoscopic display. That really is, I think, misleading. And I don't think that makes sense at all, especially when you, at the end, when you, what you deliver is a waveguide display that has two fixed focal lengths. And it's like, because you have a second waveguide at a different focus point, you get to not call your headset a stereoscopic display. And so there's like this whole Twitter thread that I'll link to in the description, like him going back and forth saying stereopsis is not stereoscopy. And it's like, stereoscopes do not enable normal eye function, but like ours do. And it's hard for me to like agree with that, especially when the Magic Leap 1 often has so much trouble even switching to the right focal plane for me. Like 90% of the time, it is not, I have something up very close, as close to that as it can render it, and it's not switching to the right focus plane. And I force it to go into that plane by converging my eyes, like, which is not physiologically normal eye function, and it switches into that right plane, and then it switches right back when I actually stop converging my eyes. The switch itself is also slow. There's a big white balance difference between the two waveguides. There's the, I mean, obviously there's the discoloration the chromatic aberration problems of waveguides that I don't think really that there's any way around it because of just the way waveguides work and the way you have to, you know, split up the RGB signals into their own specific sub waveguides, which then create this like ghosting effect.
And there is also, once again, the Carl Gutek blog article that we will link to. And he actually went through the process of doing thousands of photos and like comparing different screens and showing, in fact, that what we see in the Magic Leap, mainly the waveguide driver that is from OmniVision. I mean, technically, from what the website from OmniVision states, is that they actually can do Full HD per one instance of their technology. So one of those waveguards should technically be capable of doing Full HD. But it seems that with the Magic Leap, they do only, say, 1/4 of the resolution. And then through what he shows in the article, it is also pretty clear that you're not getting that many pixels anyway, because, I mean, first of all, it's less than what the panel could do. And then it's also through the blurring effects and all the other very easy to pick up in photo format. And he has all the photos on his blog. It's very easy to see that the image quality is not that high. And I'm really pointing out to his photos because from what Azad has been describing and from what I heard from a lot of people trying this device, I think when you put it on, overall, the experience is quite good, right? So it masks it a lot.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've been saying is like, I really do like the Magic Leap One. I think it's a pretty decent headset and I'm very excited to develop for it. And at the end of the day, when you have virtual characters in your room or you have little objects that are, you know, responding with the physics of your room, you're not thinking about these focal planes. You're not thinking about, you know, these optics technologies. You just care about, what does this look like? It's there and is it responding to my head position, you know, like all these things that create a good experience. They're actually all there. They're, I'd say, actually well designed around the limitations of the headset. So I really appreciate the amount of work that's being done there. And at the end of the day, it's a decent headset. However, it's just, I don't like seeing science being used in a deceptive way and in a jargon filled way that most people do not understand, and so that you can get away with saying the things that have been said. Like, that to me just calls, if you're going to use science in that way, you're going to have the full, you know, scientific peer review, that rigor that comes with like going over every single word, is everything being factually said, because otherwise, you know, then science really does lose its value if you just get to use terminology as however you want to use it. But again, the experience at the end of the day is not bad at all. I think it's fine. It's better. It's slightly better than what HoloLens was able to deliver a few years ago, specifically because the, you know, you have your peripheral vision constricted with the way the goggles are built, and that you've concentrated on what's more in front of you. They have much more of a darker, you know, visor in front, so that you have deeper colors, deeper, you know, blacks, as black as a see-through display can give. And apparently it blocks 85% of the like light going through. So I think Carl Gutag was making the argument that, like, can you still call this an AR headset if it's blocking most of the light? You know, like, why not just VR at that point? I mean, I get it. But I mean, to my eyes, it doesn't feel like it's 85% darker. Maybe it's because my eyes accommodate to the, you know, to the light source, or to the darker scene being seen through the glasses. And I should actually mention, I had a really cool moment the other day where Sennheiser released this loop making, beat making app for the Magic Leap. And I busted out my cello and I started kind of making loops and a little bit of music with my cello and my voice. And here I am sitting with a cello and a bow in my hand, and I have a controller in that same hand. And I had this moment where I like realized I have these interactive 3D things in front of me that I'm just controlling and because I've never, it was an experience that I've never had with the years of cello that I've played. I've always wanted to have, you know, a turn pager, right? There's all these pesky pages we have to turn in an orchestra. I've always wanted to have like an electronic version of that, and just wearing a Magic Leap 1 and interacting with these digital things in front of me really had this like, whoa, this is a freaking cool moment right now. Like I feel I was not concentrating on the headset, but I was concentrating on the music and the cello and the virtual things I was seeing in front of me very much blended into my sense of what is in this room. Like that was a really special moment that I think, even though I'm quite skeptical of like see-through AR, I had a good moment there. But again, I'm disappointed when I see people publicly saying things that can be pretty like to be held up to scrutiny, and not seeing that scrutiny happen because people don't understand these terms and don't do the research of looking into it. I felt that someone should say something about these terms, for what they're worth, for what is worth about talking about light field displays. But I think it's really important if you're going to be, again, if your main customer base for the next 3 years, right, for the next couple of iterations of Magic Leap are going to be us, people that are in this industry that care about these things and that want to know what they're dealing with, you should really try to be as transparent with them as you can, rather than try to deploy some sort of marketing terminology that you would want to use for consumers that don't care. Like, just as an example, when Apple says, you know, their cameras now have deeper pixels, like they get away with that, right? They get away with that because 99% of all their cameras, their phones, are being bought by whoever. It doesn't matter. They're not selling professional cameras to professional camera people. Like if Sony did that, you know, in their new A7 whatever, and they're like, these had deeper pixels, like people would laugh them out of the room. And I feel like that's the danger when you're building something in VR AR currently, especially not an Oculus Quest that's going to be sold to, you know, younger and console gamers. This is Magic Leap 1 is not being bought by the same people that are going to buy an Oculus Quest. You have to really be truthful and honest to your initial developer community that you're trying to foster. Like that was what the entire point of LeapCon was, this convention that I ended up going to as well, was to build, it was to bring everyone together, was to show them the future that, you know, like Magic Leap's got a lot behind the corner or around the corner, and there's a lot of really good developers here that have awesome ideas that they want to implement. So yeah, I guess that's enough of the headset, and we can talk a little bit about LeapCon as well. It was cool. I went down there with a few friends, with Chris Gallego, with Lucas Risotto, and Aiden Wolf, and we met up with a bunch of other Magic Leap developers. They had something called the Leap Squad, which is this group of people on Twitter that have been building, I think I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, them building, you know, really interesting experiments for Magic Leap. So the conference, I mean, I'll just be honest. I had blocked off pretty much half to most of my week for this conference because it was supposed to be on Tuesday and Wednesday. So we got there on Monday, and this was held in LA. So we had a nice, you know, 5 to 6, probably 7 hour drive down. And when we got there, we set up everything, you know, our Airbnbs. And then the next morning we go off to LeapCon. We're here to do the convention, and we pick up our badges and we go inside, and we're sitting in a cafeteria, like looking at the calendar and being like, oh, there's nothing scheduled for today. This is interesting. Like, turns out it was an entire day for just like private meetings and press demos, which I was not a part of, because I was invited here as a developer. So I was like, at first I felt bad for not knowing this, but then every single other person that I talked to was also like, what? Like, this is, nobody told me this. That, you know, we thought We were told this was a two-day conference. And typically with conferences, if you do have a press day, that's like either done the day before the start of the conference or not even included in that, you know, like 3-day or 4-day conference package.
I mean, there are exceptions. There are exceptions like the Gamescom.
Sure, they can be exceptions.
Where you have like 500,000 people coming. I mean, if you have 500,000 people coming, you definitely need a dedicated day. But I assume that there weren't any 500,000 people near around the conference, right?
No, it was much. I was definitely much smaller, a little bit more intimate than that. And I didn't want to be, you know, I don't want to give them flack for this for too much, especially it's their first conference that they're organizing. But it just, if I didn't know people at this conference and in this industry, I would have just literally sat there by myself the whole day, just being like, well, I wish I was at home working. But thankfully, there was enough people that I could interact with and just exchange ideas. The second day was the keynote, which I actually woke up sick and I decided I'll just watch the live stream from bed and then go into the talks and the conference afterwards. And it was a great call because it ended up being like kind of like a 3-hour ordeal. Lots of discussions, people, guests. That was the one thing, actually, the biggest takeaway from that whole conference that they was a very small detail that they glanced over in their product roadmap was the fact that they will have 2 6 DOF controller support over the next few quarters. The reason why that's so important is because this is something that Tipitat talked about. This is something that last week's episode Lee talked about, is that if you want to be developing for an AR application, really one of the most important aspects of AR is going to be how you interact with this world. And for that, you need both hands. Like you need two hands, or you need two controllers. And a lot of people now are using virtual reality as a way to develop for AR headsets that don't exist yet. So the fact that Magic Leap is thinking about two controllers and is going to be supporting it soon, I think goes to show where they think their input method, you know, their inputs will go in the future as well. That was a big question that I had in my mind. Like, what's going to be the input method that we need to start thinking about and developing for now so that it's not outdated by, you know, generation 2 or 3? It seems like VR really has at least nailed the basics of what VR's input methods will be for the next few years. You know, both Vive wands and the touch controllers and the new Quest controllers all share the same amount of buttons, with Knuckles also being in a similar boat, except kind of adding in some more extra features like the capacitive, you know, finger tracking and all that fun jazz. But for the most part, we know what VR's input method is going to be. With AR, we're still in that phase where we're figuring out, is it hand-based? Is it controller-based? Can we still use mouse and keyboard? And I do think, at least if we're going to be doing things on, you know, for gaming or for cinematic experiences, like controllers will probably still be useful, because there's nothing like pulling a trigger if you want to be firing a gun rather than, you know, doing a HoloLens pinchy tap up in the air.
But what you just described leads me to a very, you know, kind of a point where the future of Magic Leap might be, because one of the things that they've shown and actually, you know, emphasized during the LeapCon is their focus on, you know, the enterprise apps and, you know, professional 3D design. Like they show some SketchUp demos, some Wacken stuff, some CAD data, so computer-aided design stuff. So it shows that they're definitely exploring the markets that are way more juicier, and I will explain why in a second. And also there was some news that they have now a $500 million deal with the U.S. Army, right?
I did hear about a military contract, but I don't know about the.
Yeah. So yeah.
I don't know about the amount. Is that?
I think it was something.
Where did you read that?
I have to double check that. Quick pause.
Yeah, as far as I know, there wasn't any amount that was actually announced, but there does seem to be a military contract in the works. But in terms of what was announced at the keynote, I think it seems like they're really trying hard to make sure there's a healthy grassroots developer community that is, you know, continually building things for this platform.
Bloomberg is basically saying that it's a contract which could eventually lead to the military purchasing over 100,000 headsets of program whose total cost could exceed 500 million. So yeah, that's basically
not just for buying headsets, essentially.
Yeah, I guess that's basically the main deal. So I mean, it's definitely a lot of money. And my point is, I mean, look, Azad is definitely a creative person. You will most likely, with a very high probability, create something amazing with this device because the device itself offers, as it seems, a lot of opportunity. However, the question is, for whom will Azad create it? For whom did, you know, Angry Bird company, Revo or Rival, whatever they called, created their demo? For whom are those things? And to me right now, I don't see any consumer buying the Magic Leap. And honestly, I also don't see any consumer buying a Magic Leap in the next 2 years because I don't expect the prices to drop that hard.
Or the content to really be there when it comes to gaming. Like, if VR has really been able to stay afloat and actually have positive sales figures because there's been a solid like inflow of content and games and films that are being developed for it. I think, you know, you can do cinematic experiences, but I really have a hard time. I think gaming in augmented reality is much harder a problem than trying to build a game for VR, especially because you need to be like every room is going to be different for AR, and you have to account for that, those differences. Like, the enemies have to be coming from the right part of the room, you know, for the reacting to whatever object and hiding behind the right things. I think all the procedural gaming, you know, advancements that people have been researching and building will have to be essential for AR to actually make sense, because you can't just have a static level that you're running through the same way you do with a game or in VR. So it's hard to see that. I mean, the Angry Birds launch, I think, was kind of, I don't know, it was confusing to me because it's like exactly the youngest.
Yeah.
It's like the youngest audience that doesn't exist when it comes to these devices.
And that's my point. I mean, they won't buy this device very soon. And you also clearly see that, you know, Magic Leap being, you know, a company that needs at some point also to earn money is actually going exactly after the markets that actually are very promising regards augmented reality. And that is, you know, military, and that is, you know, 3D design and stuff. And those are very corporate-like companies. And here's the point. Like, when you want to target corporates, you cannot basically be, yeah, we are rewriting your visual cortex. And also, our displays are doing light field and magic and unicorn dust. I don't think they will actually like it a lot. Because from my experience, corporates are even overwhelmed. Corporates are overwhelmed with the HoloLens. And the HoloLens is having Microsoft behind it, which is like very good at approaching those corporates, right? So you don't see a wide acceptance of the HoloLens, even though Microsoft has those channels. So I am really confused about the way Magic Leap tries to present itself as a very hip, young, innovative, crazy, hipster, amazing unicorn dust company, which it can do. I mean, why not? But then kind of still going after the same.
Yeah, especially when it comes to like even the things they were talking about in the keynote with like the Magic Verse and the layers of reality.
Oh yeah,
like I think those are all fine and great, and I think those are really important things to think about. But it's just not. I just don't see it being relevant in the next few years, especially where these are the most important, you know, growing years for AR to gain adoption with the right customers and the right people that are going to be giving you money and building content and applications for this new, you know, platform. It's hard to imagine who's Magic Leap, who Magic Leap's customer is over the next few years. Someone made the point, I think it was Carl Gutag, talking about this being used in factories. The Magic Leap One, with its peripheral vision constriction and its darker, you know, opaque visor. Carl Gutag, talking about workers in factories and, you know, workers in enterprise, it actually poses a safety risk to block the peripheral vision of these workers. You know, you can imagine someone sitting in a crane or something that you have to be doing in a factory, and yes, you know, the having a virtual overlay of the things of markers and things that you have to be moving things to and doing. However, there's a lot of health and safety standards that these factories have to abide by. And from what it seemed like the HoloLens was built for, although the experience of the constricted field of view was very apparent and it created a bad, like, you know, cinematic experience, the fact that they had it fully open was, I think, an enterprise choice. Like, this is something that can be implemented into a factory. And again, when these are the first customers that are going to be giving you multi-million-dollar contracts, it makes sense to build with them in mind. It seems like Magic Leap really doesn't care about that. And they're trying to go after people like me, people like you, Peter, people that are interested in like cinematic experiences, new, interesting experiences, which is fine, dude. Like, we love these things here, but I don't think there are that many of us, right? There aren't that many of us that are into tech and cinematics and like weird, trippy, cog-sci, you know, blending of technology.
There is another point to that. Look, I'm totally in love with XR and I want to see more crazy, amazing technology. But the reason why I want it to spread, right, the reason why I want a mass adoption of XR is because I know from science and I've seen a lot of cases where you can actually improve something with XR, you can help people with XR. And sure, of course, you can also have nice entertainment with XR. But I mean, my main motivation, I assume a lot of people who are, you know, that crazy into cocci and basically, you know, trying, you know, to get a mass adoption of this stuff is, you know, that all hospitals have finally, you know, VR and some pain management stuff. So there are more PTSD stuff, or there are more PTSD mitigation and PTSD helping assistance from those technology. And I mean, look, Magic Leap burned, or, you know, got a lot of money. You know, $2.4 billion is a lot of money, and they can use it for whatever they want. I mean, it's capitalism. But if they, on the one side, are somehow trying to use this amazing wealth to bring a device that I, as a techie, someone who, you know, deeply in love with, you know, how many pixels does it have? You know, yes, I love it, but I think it's missing out point where what they've been saying is not what they've been doing. I mean, I would totally be happy and actually sign what they've been saying. Like, you know, we want to change the world, we want to create holograms, we want to, you know, rewrite the visual cortex. Fine, but then do it. What they just released is a slightly improved version of the HoloLens. I don't see a mass adoption happening with that device. I mean, it's a dev kit, but it doesn't have to be a mass adoption. But what comes afterwards?
Yeah, yeah, they don't, obviously, yeah, we don't, nobody is expecting mass adoption. There's no reason to, you know, you would be silly in thinking that. And a lot of people made the mistake with, you know, Oculus One, the CV1 and the Vive. But I hope they don't position themselves in a wrong way where it's the strategy that they're trying to pursue might be okay in, you know, in the future, in the next 5 years, but just doesn't make sense for now. And if the strategy is, you know, to use these terminologies and these words to impress more investors into giving you more money, then, you know, good for you. Keep raising money and being able to, you know, bring people on that hype train of light field displays. But it seems like the reality from that is actually created from that is nowhere near the expectations that are being set up. And it's up to us. It really is up to us to like be wary of these terms and to actually look into these terms and to educate the people that care. Because again, we've been in it for a few years and a lot of these terms we had to go through very like meticulously and understand what is being said here and what is fact from fiction. So I hope this has been somewhat of an informative podcast. And like I said, I don't have particularly negative opinions about Magic Leap as the headset or even the company. I want to throw a shout out. Michael Hazani, you've been doing an incredible job when it comes to the developer community that you've been fostering, to, you know, showcasing the really interesting use cases that people have been coming up with. And I think there's actually a lot of really good design choices that were made for the headset. The fact, you know, the light pack that is in your pocket rather than being in your head is not bad at all. I think you can probably, you know, have a bigger battery in there and more processing than you could on your head. The way the optics are being designed around with the goggles, or just on the UI side, like, I think there's a lot of really nice touches that were put there. And a lot of love and care that has been put into this device. And for them, like, I commend you for pushing this industry forward. However, on just like Silicon Valley is so known for, you know, overhyping things that aren't really there, and like, you know, trying to just charm your way through these things. And I know, Magic Leap is not a Silicon Valley company, but they were in Silicon Valley to fundraise, and they use a lot of Silicon Valley terminologies and strategies. And as I, you know, live in San Francisco and deal with a lot of companies here, I just grow wary of things that are just common ways of raising money in Silicon Valley that just are not consumer friendly.
And also don't bring the world forward, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, maybe you can make the argument that, like, you know, if they hadn't made these extravagant claims about light fields, then the AR industry itself would not be, you know, at the pace that it's growing at now. The same way that if Facebook had not bought Oculus, like, the VR industry would not be here now. But I don't think those are equivalent situations to be comparing to. But that's just me. As a correction, actually, I'm just realizing this now. The near clip plane is not at 27 centimeters, but at 37 centimeters is what I have been able to find. And as another aside, if you want to have these conversations and if you're interested in these display technologies, we have a channel in our Discord group called Display Tech, where we really like to dive into these discussions and talk with each other. So yeah, you can join us there, and if you have any more thoughts about Magic Leap
or some insights, share them.
Or some insights.
That was the
so. That's that, and I think we might have I would love to talk more about kind of AR and pass through AR. For the past few episodes, we've kind of covered some topics about, you know, designing for AR, which I'm very much excited about, and that's kind of one of the main core reasons why I found myself in this field was to apply cognitive science, you know, the way your brain works, into how things should be designed. So. If you like this conversation, you should go back and check out some of our previous episodes, in particular the one with Lee Vermeulen, the founder of Modbox, who's been doing a lot of design for AR. Apart from that, thank you all for listening. You can find the Research VR podcast Twitter at ResearchVRcast. You can find me at Azadux. And you can find Peter at Resilio.
And thank you to all the Patreons.
Yes. Thank you for all the Patreons. I will give you a shout out at the end here. We look forward to seeing you guys next time.
Woo.
Goodbye.
Bye.